This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com.
Good morning, everyone. It is Sunday, July 6th. And this is our final Laws of Shabbat class. So the goal for today is basically just a review of stuff from the past, however, it's almost a year, I think, that we've been doing this, close to it. So the first thing that I have to ask is, anyone have any questions? So anything that we did that wasn't clear, anything that might not remember, need a little bit of a refresher on, anything that seems still ambiguous or not so sure about? Don't be shy. This is like perfect time to ask and hash all this stuff out, because laws of Shabbat are really long, really, I don't want to say complicated, but there are a lot of details there to keep in mind. Anything come up often?
This is actually a question that I had this weekend, where I spent Shabbos at another place.
You don't have to explain, like, why you're not here for Shabbos.
No. But I noticed that women wore makeup.
Yeah.
Like, very clearly wore makeup.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked, that coloring? And they're like, well, it's not feminine.
Right. So, okay, so a couple of things here. One, like I mentioned when we did that class, some women who put on makeup on Friday, like put it on before Shabbat. Okay. The other issue is it's not permanent. But as we saw there, the permanent thing at best would knock it down from a biblical to a rabbinic prohibition, at best. Doesn't mean it's permissible. But you are hitting on something that is really important, not just for Shabbat, but for all of halacha. I sometimes joke that when people ask me a halachic question, I tell them, you know, here's what I think the law is, I explain why, and I assume people are going to do whatever they want to do anyway. That's the dirty secret of Orthodox Judaism, where at the end of the day, people are going to do whatever it is they do, whether or not it's usually because they're used to it or because everyone around them does it, not because they actually have a real understanding of the law. And thanks to what the Hebrew tumors peel pool, legal casuistry, where people can find some justification for virtual anything, you sort of work backwards, where you say, well, here's what we do, here's what we're accustomed to do, and then you work backwards to find the justification for it, whether or not it makes any sort of halachic sense. Where it gets tricky is if you're a rabbi in a community and you see people who are doing something that they really shouldn't be doing, how do you go about communicating that message? Because on one hand, you think, well, a rabbi is supposed to tell people when they're doing something wrong. On the other hand, there's a principle that actually comes up with the laws of Shabbat, specifically regarding dancing and clapping, which, as we saw, is rabbinically forbidden. When it's discussed in the Gemara, an idiom comes up there, mutav shiyu shogegim ve'al yehu mezidin. Better people sin in error than sin intentionally. If people don't know better, better let them do it than if you say, hey, you can't do that anymore, and they ignore you, right? Because then you're no longer sinning unintentionally, saying, oh, I didn't know. It's now you knew, and you just don't care. All right. So that could also be, you know, a huge difference. If you go up to someone and say, the way that you've been living your Jewish religious life is wrong, you will meet a lot of resistance. And I say this with a great deal of experience. People don't like being told that they're wrong, especially when they're used to doing it and no one's told them otherwise.
So I was going to even ask.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. It depends. When you see a case like that, you can always ask a question. If you don't want to ask them, you can ask a rabbi. Or like the rabbi is like, hey, I noticed a lot of the women here wear makeup. I always thought that was forbidden. Right? Because it was coloring. Now, maybe the rabbi can say like, oh, well, here's such and such a reason. The rabbi can say, you're right, but there's nothing I can do. right? So, like here in the Lower East Side, we don't have an Eruv. And I've spoken in shul about rings. People still wear rings to shul on Shabbat. So I'm not going to, like, single out people because most of the synagogue is not fully observant. So you have to pick your battles and figure out what to do. And I've had, you know, people have asked, there was an incident in the shul, Shabbat also, where there was a baby naming. And family came in, unobservant family came in, brought the baby, brought lots of other people, and someone in the shul said, how do you do that? I said, how do you do what? How do you bring this newborn infant to shul without an eruv, because you have to carry the baby? And I said, well, you can't. That was it. Like, halachically, this was not correct or appropriate to do. They still did it. I wasn't informed of this in advance. But what am I going to do at that point? I'm not going to say, no, do not take your child home.
Go home, baby.
No, not go home, baby. You're talking about an infant, right? You're talking about, like, maybe a week old, if that much. Baby's not going anywhere. I'm not going to tell them, like, yes, do not leave the baby by us over Shabbos. Like, there's a certain degree of seichel, of intelligence, like when something happens. So the member who called me out on it was completely right for doing so. Certainly better ask the rabbi than ask the people, lest you embarrass them, especially because not everyone who does stuff, even who keeps Shabbat, know exactly what they're doing or why. You saw this with the kashrut class that we gave a while back. People do things in the kitchen. Very few people have actually learned Yeridaya inside. Virtually no one has learned Chulin, right? The basis for a lot of the laws of kashrut. So people do it because that's what they're used to. However, you are always, 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 always allowed, if not encouraged, to ask questions. If not of the people themselves, of, like, the local rabbi there who might know the community a little bit better. It's probably one of the biggest jobs of a rabbi is to teach Torah, which means that you have to be open to questions. You strike me as a polite enough person that you're not going to attack someone, right? Because they're, again, the more aggressive you ask people, the more it would appear to them as if you're challenging them, and the more you challenge, the more someone is going to get defensive. But if you ask as an inquiry, as like, hey, here's what I thought, I see something different, can you explain the discrepancy? Most people are going to be receptive, and I found that too. Like, recently I had a conversation with a Chabad rabbi here, where I asked him a question about a Chabad minhag regarding Pesach, and I wasn't trying to pick a fight with him, because I'm not going to convince him, like, hey, don't do your practice, and he's not going to convince me our practice is right, but I also don't care. I was generally interested, why does Chabad do something like this? Because I'd like to know. People ask me these questions, and I like knowing stuff, and, you know, fine. Are we going to disagree on halacha? Likely, but that's the difference between picking a fight with someone and trying to gain information. So you are always, always, always allowed to ask someone to get information. Better to ask rabbis than not, because, again, you can get it. They will hopefully understand the halacha better than the individual. If you're dissatisfied with the rabbi's answer, or you ask someone, like, the difference of permanence, you can maybe ask for a little bit more question, you know, follow-up questions, but you have to have a little social awareness to see if someone's becoming uncomfortable with it. Because I've also found that people, when you even explain it, like, in detail, like, hey, here's why you're wrong, just go ahead and blithely ignore you. My father even had one example like that in Springfield, where my father was a rabbi. He would say when it came time for duchening, on Yom Tov, and the Kohanim blessed the congregation, he said, look, cover your head fine, do not turn your backs to the Kohanim. And like 2 seconds after he said that, people still did. Like, there's only so much you can do. But if it's a matter of, you know, I see a discrepancy, you're always free to ask. And you're also always free to ask follow-ups. One of the reasons why I'm very insistent on giving out detailed source sheets is, if you see something else, you can take those source sheets to another rabbi and say, well, you told me one thing, and here I have this source that tells me something else. Now, that rabbi could give you an answer or not give you an answer. If he gives you an answer, you can then come back to me and say, well, this is what that rabbi said, how do you respond? Right? And that's one way that you can actually gain greater knowledge and understanding. It's usually a bad idea to play two rabbis off each other, but when you're trying to gain more information, you know, these are questions that you might not have thought of. It's like, hey, that's a good point. I wonder how he's going to answer that. And then go back, right? And in some respects, that's actually how the Gemara works, where you know, you'll have two opinions, and then you'll have almost this an after the fact dialogue. Well, how would this person answer? How would that person answer? How would this person answer? And that way, you may not get a resolution, but you'll understand two positions a lot better. All right, I hope that answered the question.
Yeah.
Okay. Because, I mean, that's a wonderful question, because it's not just loss of Shabbat. It's also how do you deal with these discrepancies? You see someone doing something that you thought was incorrect. Now, I have to also compliment you with that, because the fact that you naturally asked the question instead of assuming they did something wrong is something that not a lot of people do these days. And I find it's shockingly common that from people who aren't rabbis, who would say, like, oh, you're not allowed to argue with great rabbis, et cetera, have no problem poskening for other people and saying, you just did something wrong. Why? Because this is what you heard from your particular rabbi. But unless you actually, like, have, in theory, that's what smicha is supposed to be, right? Unless you are 100% sure that there's no arguments here, like, don't go and trafe up someone's kitchen unless you really know what's going on. So, same thing, like, don't say, oh, you're being mechalel Shabbos when, you know, they may or may not be, depending on one thing or another. So, what else you got?
I don't know. Like, it's just interesting going to other people's homes, communities, practicing how they do things differently, like seeing someone make a cup of tea, even though they're using a hot pot.
Yeah.
But
so, how do they make the cup of tea?
With a tea bag.
Like, tea bag first and then water, or water first then tea bag?
It was, I put the tea bag in a cup and then the other cup.
Yes.
But
the whole cliche thing there. Yeah.
But I thought we couldn't, like, I don't know. We need the Shabbos kitchen. It was like, you can't make tea out of tea bags.
All right. No, well, thank you for bringing this up. This is exactly why I wanted to do this review thing here. So, let's go over that again.
I mean, I didn't say anything. Cause
you are a very intelligent person. Good job. Yeah.
Like,
also, bad idea to insult your hosts.
Right.
Bad idea. So, regarding the teabags, let's go over that again. So, we know that cooking on Shabbat is forbidden. Principle of Ein Bishul B'Kli Sheni. What is that kli sheni again? The hot water pot, the urn, is a kli rishon, which is the first vessel, the vessel of direct heat, right? Because that urn is heated up, right? When you pour out iruri from a kli rishon, it is as if you put something in there directly. So if I have a tea bag, I put it in this cup over here, I pour hot water directly from the urn on here, that is considered pouring from the first vessel, and I might as well have dropped the tea bag in the urn itself, in which case I violated cooking. Principle, though, of Ein Bishul B'Kli Sheni. So if I pour in the water from the urn into the cup first, then I add the tea bag, technically speaking, I did not do Bishul, because once the water is in the cup itself, meaning it's no longer in the process of being poured, it's now a secondary vessel, and then put one in. There are some people who will use a kli shlishi, which is pour water into one cup, this becomes a kli sheni, pour it into this cup, this becomes a kli shlishi, and then put the tea bag in here. Note, you would still have to put the tea bag in second, because if you poured from the second one on directly, you might as well have just put it in the second one, right? See that whole iruri? The pouring thing is whatever the first cup is, not on the second one. Okay. So the reason why people use a kli shlishi is because of what people say is kale habishul, things that are very easy to cook. Now, tea leaves are easy to cook, I suppose, because they're small and whatnot. So for that reason, people like doing it that way. Remember what I also said at the very beginning of the Rambam class? The more specific you get in terms of scenarios, the more machloket you're going to have, the more disputes you're going to have, the more different ways of doing things you have. So some people, like myself, are fine with a kli sheni because straight Gemara. Other people go through the kli shlishi all the way down, and as you said, some people say, well, you can't make tea at all on Shabbat because no matter what you do, you might come to cook it at all. And that's also assuming that the tea itself isn't cooked in some way before it actually, I have no idea how tea is processed. So it's also another principle of Ein Bishul Achar Bishul. Like, once something is cooked, it can't be recooked. All right? So all of those things, you can always, like, there, if you're interested in part of the halachic process series, there was a four-part segment on stringencies and taking on new things, right? But there's an important difference, like I said, between what is the ikar hadin halacha. Like, if you want to be strict on these things, usually it doesn't actually impede Jewish law. Meaning, there's no obligation to drink tea on Shabbat. Well, for some of us, it might be oneg, right? Right. This is how we enjoy Shabbat, with a nice cup of tea. But aside from that, there's nothing that says you must drink tea on Shabbat. So if someone says, all right, so I'm not going to drink tea on Shabbat, they don't violate Jewish law. It's like someone who doesn't want to rely on an eruv. You don't have to carry on Shabbat. So, all right, so you don't use the eruv, you still haven't violated Shabbat. The difference more comes up is if you tell someone else you're doing something wrong. Right, so if you're going to tell someone, you know, you're doing something wrong, it's like, well, here's my source. Well, my rabbi said otherwise. Well, why do I have to listen to your rabbi? I've got this rabbi. Like, oh, you, and then it's, you know, that whole my rabbi can beat up your rabbi thing, and it kind of goes down from there. So, yeah, you will find stringencies in some areas, and you'll find leniencies in others, which people may or may not know how to justify as much as, well, this is what everyone does. Either these are things that you were trained to do, like this is how you grew up, this was the Shabbat that you observed, or there's a sense sometimes that the stricter you are, the better you are. And that's why I gave, like, the four-part series in Chumras. So that's really not true. I shouldn't say it's not true in the sense it's not an absolute. There are times when doing more is considered praiseworthy. There are times when trying to do more leads to criticism. Right, so there's no straight answer with that, so I refer you to those questions. But yeah, you will find differences. Asking people why, always a good thing. Asking rabbis why, hopefully you'll get a better answer depending on the rabbi. Because, I mean, even if they may know more, they can still be... Some rabbis don't like handling questions and don't really know how to actually address a point. So maybe you can do better, maybe not, but there's no problem in asking the question. Right? But you understand the difference between the pouring stuff? Okay. What else? What else came up? You sound like fun people. What?
Like when you don't have anything to do, you take a nap.
Yes, naps are very good on Shabbos.
Especially a long Shabbos.
The problem with it, though, is sometimes, like...
It's a long nap, you wake up, and it's still Shabbos for 3 more hours.
Right, and then it throws off your sleep schedule. So when I used to, you know, go to Hashgama Minyan, I'd be able to take a nap and still enjoy the rest of Shabbos. So, yeah, I mean... There are people who do get a bit stir-crazy on Shabbat because, well, there's not a whole lot you can do. And that can be somewhat unfortunate because, you know, if you go back to Shabbat, it's like this day of rest and contemplation. You know, you could actually, you don't just try to sleep it off, right? You might, I mean, if you worked really hard during the week, you might not have a choice and you just crash. But it's not something that ideally we're supposed to wait out and, you know, find something to pass, you know, the time and the boredom, right? Read, even just going outside for a walk and trying to enjoy stuff. It could be, it's something which I'm going to experience soon. There's a joke that in America we have Shabbat Sheni Shel Galiyot, the second day of Shabbat for the exile, which is Sunday. Because in Israel, Sunday's a normal day. So it's a bad joke. But so with our Sundays, it could seem like, let's get it over with. But if you had to go into work today and your work day was really like Sunday through Thursday and Friday you're busy getting ready for Shabbat and Shabbat you can actually like wind down, Shabbat might be a very different experience. So I don't know, maybe we just get too lazy with Sunday. So who knows? What? Oh, yeah, that's so awesome. Well, the thing is, so with me, you know, since I never really had like a full day off, like there was always that low level thing of working, I'm not sure how much of a transition that's going to be. If I had a regular 9-to-5 job, sure. But that is an interesting point. There are some people who just get overly bored on Shabbos. And it's somewhat unfortunate because, you know, even there, I mean, look, we saw like certain things you might consider more Shabbistic than others. But even just to like sit down and talk to people, right, without texting without emailing.
Oh, no, it's great. I mean, I learned how to play 20 questions. It's great.
There you go. Right? Now, you can say on one hand, well, these are silly, like, time-wasting things. On the other hand, you can actually bond with other humans, right? Which can be a very good thing. And it could also plug a whole bunch of Sheerman classes, but, you know, who goes to those, right? And, like, there's, look, I mean, there's a lot of, and most shuls have some sort of Sheerim or some learning thing. Or even if you don't want to go to those, like, read something. Right? How often do you get a chance to just sit and, I mean, although I will say that reading on Shabbat and doing serious learning on Shabbat can be incredibly frustrating when you can't write down stuff. And you can't underline things. So a recommendation for those, 3M has those post-it flags. Those are clutch for Shabbos. Because, like, instead of just folding down a page and you don't remember where, you put a post-it flag by the sentence on the side, right? And it's like, oh, right, I saw something cool there. You just have to remember, like, after Shabbat, like, oh, let me get down what I saw. So post-it flags, very, very...
The ones with the signature ones, because they have the arrows...
They're a little more expensive, though.
Okay.
Right. So you can get, like, the multicolored pack if you're... I mean, they're not cheap, but, you know, they're still quite effective enough, at least. All right? Anything else?
Silly question.
No silly questions. There are no such thing.
Blowing bubbles on Shabbat.
Like soap bubbles?
Yeah, like, you know...
Used to play with those. So, what do you think? Throw it out here. Blowing bubbles.
Oh.
That actually came up? I mean, I was a kid, so like, oh sure, blowing bubbles. So what do you think?
I want to say no.
Okay, why? What does it seem like?
Only because it looks like you're drawing an O.
All right, so drawing could be one question. Like, are you in fact drawing something? So all these soap bubbles are is you're doing it into like a soapy mixture. You're blowing, and it's you might say it's like creating maybe this temporary thing of soap. My own instinct is I can't... It's not coming to me what specific prohibition you would be violating. Because are you really bona? Are you really creating something? I don't know. It doesn't seem to me like you're actually building something because it's just a film of soap, right? So you've got like a little like circle thing which pops in matters of seconds after, you know, I don't know exactly how the thing degrades, but I would always like remember like looking at it in the sun and you see a whole bunch of colors and you see these like black spots come in. Once it gets too black, it just like pops. So yeah, I don't, it might. Nothing's coming to me offhand to think about why it would be prohibited. Because, like, the material there is just soap, right? And it's liquid soap. So, in theory, like, you could use it for any number of purposes, including washing your hands.
That's what I was thinking, too.
Right.
I read in some places they'll, like, creating something new. But then I'm like, if you wash your hands, it's the same.
Yeah, when you wash your hands, you're actually creating bubbles in the water there. So, I don't see why this specific thing would be different. But I'm sure you will find someone to tell you it would be prohibited. Though it doesn't occur to me exactly how. So, again, odds are someone says it's a problem. Mm-hmm. Just statistically. Anything else? Right, but that was also, like, you know, a fine example about, like, how to approach the question. You might have an intuition about, like, again, if you don't want to blow bubbles on Shabbat, don't blow bubbles. But if you want to say, like, it's actually prohibited, you have to explain under what category is this violate biblical Shabbat or rabbinic Shabbat. Either, like, those are your two options there, right? So if you want to say it's somewhere under bona, under creating, or, like, building, you have to say, well, is this in fact... what was actually part of the decree. We saw a bit of with that with the electricity class, where, you know, you have this, I don't want to say electricity is new, but like electricity, and we have all these appliances, that didn't exist in the time of the sages when people needed to deal with it. It wasn't like you say, oh, it's forbidden. You have to demonstrate how was electricity come under the category or one of our pre-existing halakhic categories to say such and such is prohibited for this reason. And you have to demonstrate how does it line up. And for that, we have like a whole separate series on that. All right, but that's the approach to the question. How does this violate biblical Shabbat? How does this violate rabbinic Shabbat? And you have to prove those in order to say it's asur. If you want to say don't do it as a matter of policy, that's something else. You can always say as a matter of policy, we don't do this. It's not what we do, which is very different than saying it's forbidden. All right, and then you can also get into laws of minhag hamakom if you're in a specific case and you have a special class on the laws of minhag in the halachic process one. Anything else? Questions on... Yeah, I'm not going to quiz people on what exactly the 39 malachot are. All right. No.
I'm still on, like, the little red guys and the green guys.
It's a great book, isn't it?
It is. It's so great.
Yeah. It's a phenomenal book. That's the 39 malachot book by, I think it's Chait. It's just a really great, you know, summary of things like that.
Yeah, if I ever had people, like, asking me, what books do you recommend? I totally just recommend kids books.
The Karin Children's Siddur.
Yeah. And it's not complete. It's really weird.
The Karin Children's
Siddur? Yeah, it's really beautiful. Like, it's illustrated. It's...
What is it missing?
Like,
that's a pretty big omission.
It's a great book. Like, it's illustrated wise, and it gives you little questions. Like, what are you thankful for today? And stuff like that. Yeah. But at the same time, it's just missing. I was like, there's a whole chunk missing. But it's great because it's like big type for kids. And
glossy pages so that they can... Cool. All right. All right, so we got the basic thing. So again, biblical, rabbinic, things that are permitted. Another thing that's important for practicality stuff, again, stacking rabbinic prohibitions can sometimes, if you're stuck in an emergency, you can make things permissible, again, depending on like what the scenario is. Risa, any questions? None? You're good with Shabbos?
Well, I missed the class. With the Havdalah and all that.
All right.
No, that's too much.
Well, make Kiddush, make Havdalah. We discussed that there was a bit of... So when it comes to Kiddush, a woman can make Kiddush for a man, should that come up. We actually did... When I was at University of Chicago, it was a compromise that we came up with where a woman would always lead Kaddish... A woman would always do Kiddush, and a male would always lead benching. And because that way, like, halacha was kept, you know, like, straight, because benching is a whole other separate issue. But a woman can certainly make kiddush for a man. There seemed to have been a bit of a dispute about whether or not a woman can make havdalah for a man, whether or not the same obligations of distinguishing between the weekday and Shabbat on the front end is the same as distinguishing on the back end. Right, so if they're identical, then yes, a woman could make havdalah on behalf of a man. If they're not, then no. But that's a short for it. Otherwise, like, yeah, Kiddush Havdalah, do it. And a few other requirements, like, you know, you're not supposed to do malacha before you do Havdalah. You're not supposed to eat before you do Havdalah, stuff like that. But those are things which people do almost naturally without, you know, really knowing, like, the halacha or knowing the why. You know, and that's, you know, something where we do things out of habit. Now, if you're raised in an Orthodox household, odds are you're going to get a lot of the observant stuff correct. But on the flip side, if you're taught to do something that's incorrect, what do you go about doing with that? And that gets a bit tricky because you'll find a lot of inconsistency there about, well, you know, on one hand, like, you know, well, all right, so you're doing something wrong, so you should change it, but this is my tradition. Well, your tradition is wrong. Well, can a tradition be wrong? Let's now start evaluating traditions. And then the whole thing falls apart. So like, no, our traditions are fine. Your traditions are the one that's bad. And, you know, then it gets a bit dicey if that's like the game that you're going to play. But the truth is, that's how people operate. Are you saying that my father did something wrong? It's like, well, kind of. Like, here's why. But that's why you have to be very tactful, you know, when you're actually telling people stuff like that. So from position of rabbi, you really have to be super tactful, and hopefully you do have that tact. A lot of other people don't, and yet feel comfortable freely telling people, you're doing something wrong. Like, stop that. Yeah, again, it doesn't go over well. Remember something else?
No, I just was thinking about how there's like this siddur that David had growing up, like as a kid. It's like this blue cover. It's an older one, but they have the thing where.
Is that the burn bound? Is it like a light blue?
No, it's like a dark blue.
Dark blue. Okay. You would know that. Is it like the light blue in the back over there?
Yeah.
Bottom shelf?
Yes.
That's the burn bound.
But they had like this thing where they had Kiddush side by side by doing Kiddush with wine, and you could do it with bread.
Yes, we did that too.
Yeah.
Right, so if you happen not to have wine, you could make Kiddush on Friday night over bread.
Yeah.
You would wash first, you would say, instead of, you know, saying Baruch Piragav, you'd say Motzi Lechem Min Haaretz, and then continue with Kiddush.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I just thought that was really interesting, and I was told that it's because there was a point when that book was published that people didn't have money for wine, so you would have to.
The halacha,
and it was like, it was so common to do it over bread.
So the halacha is, it can be done. It is preferable to do it over wine than bread. Another reason why it's important to know these laws is, let's say you happen to be stuck someplace. So years back, I spent Shabbat in Arizona. Didn't have wine, right? So I was able to, had to do hamotzi, or, sorry, had to do kiddush over bread. Had to do havdalah over beer, because we just did not have kosher wine. Beer was a little easier to come by than kosher wine in Arizona, or at least where I was. So it's not something which we seek out to do. There are things that we try to do, but it's still important to know that it can be done, because when you do get stuck, you'll know what to do. I don't know in terms of like Siddur publications, you know, like what people include and what people don't include, because there are things which are halachically permissible that, yeah, we don't want to encourage people to do that. Like, well, why not? Like, shouldn't people know? Because when people get stuck, they don't know what to do, might say, yeah, don't do anything. Like, well, no, there are other options here. So, yeah.
Is it preferable to do it over bread than a different beverage?
If you don't have wine, then do it over bread. For Friday night, it's either wine or bread. For Shabbat day, we can do it on anything called chaymar medina, any alcoholic beverage. You would just say the appropriate bracha. So if you're doing kiddush on Shabbat day, you can do it over scotch and just say shahakol, and you're fine, right? But for the night, you would not do it over whiskey. You would either do it over wine, and as we discussed, like wine that was ra'ui for the mizbeach, at least according to Rambam in the Gemara, or you would do it over bread.
How about grape juice?
So with grape juice, it would depend on the type of grape juice and how all of that stuff is done. If you go to Israel, there are certain brands that have a specific label that says Kasher Levarich Bor Pri Agafen Gam Lefi Shitat Maran Beit Yosef, where the Israeli grape juice tastes more like freshly squeezed grapes. Some, like Americans I know, called it raisin wine. It's like, yeah, because it's freshly squeezed grapes, not the stuff that we have. So if you do have something like freshly squeezed grapes, like even according to Rambam, you'd be okay, right? Because it's still just non-fermented grape juice and would still be rotwi for the Mizbeach. I don't know where you can get that in America today. Shulamis said they didn't even carry this stuff at the KRM. Yeah. So, yeah, diluted stuff is bad, but... What?
It's delicious. It's candy water.
I'm not saying it isn't delicious, but you know, there are better grape juice. Well, I shouldn't say that. I don't want to like bash Ketem or give other endorsements here. You know, it's something which I never did. I should have like held up a thing as like, hey, if you'd like, you know, have like endorsements and product placements and podcasts. Like, hey, try this Ketem grape juice. Cha-ching! Yeah.
So you couldn't you couldn't, like, have a juicer and juice some grapes?
Sure.
Oh, you could.
Yeah, do it before Shabbos.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay.
Do you actually have a juicer? Right. Also, you would have to...
It's just
the number of... The number of... I also wouldn't recommend it, because one of the issues with juicers is there's only so much they can extract. So in order for you to have a usable amount of grape juice from a juicer, you would have to put in so many grapes.
Yeah.
You'd be better off putting the grapes in a blender and blending the stuff and, like, dealing with the, you know, skins on there and use that. It's one advantage of blenders over the juicers, in that you get a lot more of the nutrients and a lot more of the fruits and vegetables that you put in there. And I say this not actually owning a blender. If you actually use a blender, I've never needed a blender, immersion or otherwise. Yeah, here's a question. Do you have to Tovel an immersion blender?
If it's metal.
An immersion blender?
Oh.
Yeah. Yes, that was not a serious question there. Anyway, moving along.
But I did
Tovel
my immersion.
Yes, Tovel.
It's a stainless.
There you go. Cordless or cordful?
It's cordful, but it comes with a bunch of attachments. So it has the blender, like, sit-down blender attachment.
Yeah.
It also has a mixer, so I can make milkshakes with it.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. I had the coupon. No, it's a Cuisinart, but it's...
The Vitamix is a bit of a cult. And it's not something I ever thought I'd see in my lifetime. There's a cult around a blender.
Will it blend?
That is a funny YouTube series. Well, at least it was back in the early days. There's probably still going. And there's a blender company. Baskin-Robbins uses their blenders. That had a YouTube series called Will It Blend? Where you would just, like, throw random stuff in a blender and just, like, mash it all up. The cooler one they did were, like, glow sticks for Ray's, and he, like, came up with this lantern of, like, glowing material. The only thing that did not blend was Chuck Norris. I think I sent you that video, even. Yeah.
I just had an answer to your bubble question.
Yeah.
It's totally okay, because I've seen people use a soda stream on Shabbos and blowing CO2 bubbles into water, but it's not an electronic device, so it's okay.
Right, so good logic there. With the one, I mean, I think good logic there. There's one slight concern there, is that the assumption is that people are doing it means it's okay. Right? It's theoretically possible. Listen, I happen to agree with you, right? But remember, like, if what you would have to do is find someone who says, well, the soda stream is okay, and then say, well, if the soda stream is okay, why is that different than blowing soap bubbles, right? But remember, just because people do it does not necessarily mean it's okay, all right? It's not a bad assumption if you might not know any better, right? And if you find, like, an incongruity between two actions, then you can call people out on that, right? So if someone uses a soda stream but doesn't want you to blow bubbles, you can say, well, for you, what's the difference? And it's possible they just haven't thought of it, right? But I think it's a great, great, you know, insight. So, well done. We'll put you on the rabbinical school track soon.
Question.
Yeah.
What about the exercise machine that doesn't use a motor? Totally. It has a flywheel.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. So yeah, there are a bunch of those.
I have one.
Not just for you. If you go south on Clinton Street, like if you go all the way to the river, like you go on Clinton Street all the way to the end and you hang a right, the city actually just put up very rudimentary exercise equipment.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's like all, it's interesting. It's based off of the weight of the participant, and it's got like almost gym stuff, like a bench press thing. It's got like a rower.
Wow. That's going to be peed on.
No, but you're talking about, like, solid metal stuff here, right? It's not like they put up gym equipment. They put up public gym equipment. Take a look at it. It's something that people have actually been using. So would those be permissible on Shabbat? So what do you think? Let's throw it open. Using some of these exercise equipment on Shabbat that involve no electricity.
Right.
Why?
Because you're exerting yourself.
Lauren?
What about, like, the whole you might come to... Like, with riding a bike, you can't ride a bike on Shabbat.
Okay.
So that's not
Why can't you ride a bike on Shabbat?
Because he might come to fix it.
Hmm? Are you asking?
I think
so. Okay, so you got one possibility. He might come to fix it, and your point was? Exertion.
Exertion.
Which is a problem because?
Well, there's also the... With a bicycle or running, there's a chance that you'll dig up some ground or something.
Interesting. Okay, which you wouldn't have on a stationary treadmill.
But there's a chance that it could fly off.
Okay, all right. So, all right, good attempts here. Good attempts here. So, let's take one thing at a time here. So, we'll get back to the bicycles because that's a question that comes up a whole lot. So, the exertion thing, got a great point there on, right? You're doing not so much... Right. Remember, there's a difference between the halachic categories of melacha, of work, and there are other things involving the physical exertion, like as you mentioned. And there's a bit of a range of differences of opinions here in terms of what exactly would, under what category would that really come under, right? So what specific melacha would you be doing by, let's say, walking on a treadmill, all right, that isn't hooked up to anything? Let's say you've got a... Or, what's another good example? The gazelle. Anyone remember the gazelle?
I have a ski machine.
The gazelle is even simpler, right? The gazelle is, you just like go like this. It's funniest infomercials you're going to see, like this really hyperactive guy. I forget, the guy's Little, something Little, I think.
Me, right?
Tony Little, I think that's his name. Oh, you need to watch more infomercials. Anyway, so very simple thing, just moving stuff back and forth, right? Doing any sort of halachic melacha, well, you'd have to find the exact one that you'd be doing. Exercising, while it might not be specifically under, it could be under that general rubric of something that is, quote, not Shabbistic, that we spent some time on. Now... The reason why this gets a little bit tricky in terms of to peg down exactly what the prohibition is taking it to the logical conclusion. So let's say one explanation that I heard is physical exercise to the point where you sweat. Like, okay, but then how do you walk to shul in the summer? All right, if sweating is a problem with physical exertion, spending time outdoors, walking can create that same effect as running for however long. All right? The bike issue is something that comes up a bit. Like, you might come to fix it, but you also might not. Meaning, the Gemara never actually specifically said bicycles are forbidden for that reason, simply because bicycles didn't exist. Right, but what you said is correct in the sense that people have made that argument. Is it something which I say is universal? That gets a little bit trickier, right? And also with is it Shabbistic? Someone asked me in the shul, well, what if you only ride your bike on Shabbos? Right? Because then, you can't say that's not Shabbistic because you don't do it during the week. Difficult questions here. They get into the specifics behind it. The picking up dirt was an interesting one. Now, I heard a reason for that about why you shouldn't play basketball outdoors. Because playing outdoors, like, you're usually doing it on asphalt, right? And then you're, like, leveling out stuff. But then you could also argue it might be a, was it the psik resha de lo nichale? Like, it's a non-inevitable consequence that you really don't care about. Meaning, just because you bang a basketball on the asphalt, you may or may not kick stuff up. Same thing with a bike. You may or may not kick stuff up depending on where you are, and you don't care that that's going to happen. As we saw before, there's a distinction between inevitable consequence and the non-inevitable consequence. Right, so with bike riding, it's not inevitable that you're going to pick stuff up. It depends where you're riding, how fast you're riding, and all that good physics stuff. Same thing with basketball. In terms of the physical exertion thing, that you're going to find multiple opinions on. It's, again, difficult to peg down. Here's the specific prohibition on Shabbat you're violating. The non-Shabbistic thing might be a catch-all, but it's something that you could almost intuitively, just how subjective that is. People say it's not done, not in the spirit of the day, all that good stuff. But it's a means of discouraging without actually saying, why is it forbidden? It's a very different question to ask. But, you know, given, you know, fitness in America saying, like, I want to exercise on Shabbat. I was like, really? Really you want to exercise on Shabbat? Yeah.
But chances are I wouldn't do it anyway because you have to take a shower after it.
So, and there's that, and then you get the whole Bishul issue, but yeah. It could also come into other things like Muktzah, right, which was, you know, a whole other category there about things that you're not allowed to move, about, you know, does it really have a purpose or function and all that sort of thing. One of the categories of Muktzah is a Kli Shemelachto Li'isur. If the vessel is specifically used for something that's prohibited, right, then the actual item itself becomes prohibited. So if the only purpose for a bike is something that is prohibited on Shabbat, then the bike itself becomes muktzah and you're not allowed to move it. Right? So you could also apply the same thing to like the exercise equipment all the way, you know, down by East River. Which, if anyone has free time during the week or today, check it out. Although they're often in use. Yeah. I saw it when I was doing one of my jogs down there. Okay. Anything else? Alrighty. Well, thank you all very much. I hope that this was at least reasonably informative. Again, for anything that we skipped, please feel free to learn this stuff on your own. Like, just because we didn't do it here doesn't mean it's not important. I had to do my own editing for what I thought would be most relevant, but that doesn't mean that stuff is more important than the other. Chabad.org has the Rambam translation that we've been using online. So if you ever do get stuck with Rambam on your own, either for Shabbat or anything else, check out their website. Though I also really recommend getting these particular books, simply because a great thing to do on Shabbat is to sit and learn. And as you saw from the English translation is incredibly readable. So it's something which, you know, if you set up a Shabbat Seder to just learn a little bit of the Rambam, you know, a week, you can be surprised at how much you'll actually get through. I'd start with one Sefer at a time because the entire set is, I think, $700 or so. Right.
$20 each.
Yeah, so get what you're planning on using one step at a time, all right? And again, thank you all very much, and come back Wednesday for the farewell shiur.